from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next Forum Hour, does it take you 15 minutes to tell a waiter how you want your food prepared? Well, if so, you may be a picky eater. Writer Stephanie Lucianovic was one, and she lived in fear of having dinner at friends' homes or going to restaurants. Today, she's a foodie and a food writer, and she'll brave eating most anything. In the hour ahead, we'll be joined by her and a pair of researchers who look at the causes and treatments for what some are calling a selective eating disorder and others call neophobia, and others simply say is pickiness. Are there real medical conditions related to picky eating, or are picky eaters simply, well, picky? And can they change? Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. There are children and adults who are actually suffering from what used to be called being picky eaters. And there's an embarrassment and social consequences as well as other problems that regularly occur to those who refuse to eat a wide variety of foods, for a wide variety of reasons. But should picky or finicky eating be deemed a disorder or a medical condition? And what causes people to suffer, especially if it's serious and impedes with a normal life? Well, in this Forum Hour, we pick apart picky eating. And here with us in studio is Stephanie Lucianovic, who is the author of a book called Suffering Succotash. Some of you with long memories may remember that from Sylvester the Cat. It's a picky eater's guide to understanding why we hate the foods we hate. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Marcia Pelsha, who is a psychologist. She's with the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Dr. Nancy Zucker is also with us. She directs the Duke Center for Eating Disorders, and she's with us from Duke University. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have all of you, and welcome to all of you. And let me begin, Stephanie Lucianovic, with you, and let's talk about your story here. Although, you know, suffering for picky eating, or what some call finicky eating, sounds like a heavy word, and yet people really do suffer, don't they?
They do. Children do, and I did as a child, being afraid to eat at people's houses, not liking the food that was served to me all the time. But my parents were pretty laid back about it. They would say, three more bites and you're done. Still didn't want to take the three more bites. But as I got older, I became more aware of the fact that it was kind of shameful and embarrassing and that I should have grown out of it by now. When I hit about 27, I was hiding my picky eating from my then boyfriend, soon to be husband. I didn't want him to stop dating me. He ate everything, still does. And because of him and because of how much he ate, I had an impetus to get over it as best as I could, which was to hide it and just sort of eat things as I could and just try to get it down. I was more afraid of the consequences of being found out to be picky than I was of the food.
What did you imagine those consequences to be?
That he would stop dating me. That
he'd reject you because you were a picky eater?
I guess that was part of it. He would think I was some – he grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in the Midwest. I thought I would be seen as sort of provincial and, you know, not worldly, even though we met while living in England. So I was very – shy about of having that out there, having that known about me, even as an adult.
And now, well, you write for KQED's food blog, and you become sort of a champion of eating just about everything. So you can change from being a picky eater, obviously.
I can. I did. But that's not to say everyone can. There are plenty of people who can't. It's very difficult. You have to have something there that pushes you forward. And like I said, for me, it was the shame was something I was more afraid of than the food itself.
And you've done a lot of research on this now. You become a food writer, like I said, learn to like most foods. But the fact is, it gets into nature nurture. I mean, how much of it? There's genetic evidence, for example. There's even neurological evidence of picky eating, what we call picky eating. And yet at the same time, there's evidence that suggests that, like everything else, environment plays a big role.
Sure. I think if you're not introduced to certain foods at a young age, if you never have that exposure, you don't set up any sort of, I guess the scientists call it context and expectation about what these foods would be. You don't have associations, bad or good. So when you encounter them for the first time later in life, if you happen to be a more fearful eater, have food neophobia, you probably won't try them or you won't like them. Other people like my husband will try whatever, doesn't matter if he's had it before or not. So if you have a lack of exposure to certain foods, there's a possibility that will keep you picky later in life. But that's, again, just one particular area that could be affecting a picky eater. And it's not always a one for one on that.
Well, as I told you before, when in the air, I'm a picky eater. I'm coming out of the closet here. Most of my friends know this and have known it for years and family. But the sense is that maybe if my mother had worked harder on, maybe there used to be fights in my family about, my dad would say, well, just don't give him any food if he doesn't want to eat it. And my mother couldn't stand that. So she'd make, you know, a burger or something as opposed to something that I didn't want to eat. If she had continually, repeatedly introduced me to something that I don't like, egg salad or tuna fish or things with mayonnaise, I would have learned to like it.
Maybe. I know from having a three-year-old now, I've learned a lot about pediatric feeding and picky eating, and I've talked to people in the book who have picky children. And they say it can take introduction of maybe 30 to 40 times of a food. That number seems to change a lot in the literature I've read, for a child to accept it and like it. On the other hand, you can do everything right. And by everything, I mean you ate a variety of foods while pregnant. You breastfed so the baby tasted through the milk these variety of flavors. And you introduced foods constantly that were new. You can do all of that right and still have a picky eater.
There's a whole spectrum here, really, isn't there?
Huge.
A whole continuum.
Yeah.
Although the analogy I like most from your book and from other things I've read is, it's sort of like music tastes in a way. I mean, that really works for me. You go on a YouTube, for example, and you see any kind of musical recording, and doesn't matter. Thousands and thousands of people can say like, but there are people who will dislike it.
Exactly. It's like anything that we might have a preference for, but for some reason, food has become more of a fight with people, or in my experience, reasons to not date someone, as I explore in my chapter of Love and the Picky Eater. You know, the reasons for that are philosophical, I think, but also go back to food can equal love in some people's minds. And if you reject the food I like, you reject me, and we could go all therapy about that. But yes, it's a preference, and we just don't all like the same things. We're all such very different people. There's no reason why we would.
Stephanie Lucianovic, again, is the author of Suffering Succotash, A Picky Eater's Quest to Understand Why We Hate the Foods We Hate. And Marcia Pelchot is a psychologist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Well, a lot of things, it turns out, maybe your olfactory, Marcia Pelchot, our smell?
Well, I think so. I think people have neglected this aspect of picky eating. I actually became interested in this area because I am a foodie, yet my sister, who grew up in the same household, is somewhat picky. She, for example, has never eaten eggs in a form in which she can smell them. And that sulfurous smell is clearly the problem for her. And I think that although we always focus on bitter taste when we talk about children's rejection of broccoli, overcooked broccoli also stinks, as does cabbage and do Brussels sprouts. And these are some commonly hated vegetables. So I think that the sense of smell is something that needs to be investigated.
But it's also a great deal about textures, isn't it?
Yes. Texture is a huge issue with selective or picky eaters. And, you know, it's normal for someone to say, well, I don't like that bitter aftertaste. But picky eaters, at least in our culture, tend to be concerned about gelatinous or slimy textures in particular, and also changes in texture, a thin skin on a fruit or a tomato, inclusions, that would be nuts might be fine, but nuts in something are not good, lumps in a tomato sauce are not good. So yes, texture is a major issue.
And let's see if we can pin down what some of the characteristics are here, because I think it's important to understand. You mentioned the differences between you and your sister who doesn't like eggs, and both my siblings eat everything as opposed to me. So within the same family and being brought up with the same foods, it can turn out differently. But what we've learned, I guess what you've learned over at Manel in Philadelphia is there's a lot of relationship with obesity. There's a lot of relationship with OCD. And the fact is that almost all the adults who were picky eaters as children.
Yes, but not all picky children grow up to be picky adults.
Right.
Lots of them outgrow it. So the question is, why do some people change and others stay the same?
That's one of the big questions, I mean, along
yes.
with the fact that there are all these bitter taste receptors that are genetic, but we can't tell really what they activate.
Right. We still haven't managed to associate all of the bitter receptors with their ligands, that is, the chemicals that stimulate them. But we do know that people differ a great deal in bitter sensitivity and in bitter blindness. That is, not everybody expresses the same bitter receptors.
Marcia Pelsha, again, is with us from Philadelphia. She's a psychologist with the Monell Chemical Senses Center, and Dr. Nancy Zucker is director of the Duke Center for Eating Disorder. And you've set up, Dr. Zucker, a registry, a national public registry about picky eating.
That is correct.
Yeah, tell us what you've discovered as a result of that. I mean, you got a lot of data there?
Yeah, well, we certainly got a lot more responses than we expected. You know, we had set this registry up and initially did an article in the Wall Street Journal about it and kind of sat and waited around and were expecting about 600 people perhaps to reply because we weren't sure about the developmental trajectory of selective eating. And
well,
right now we have about over 30,000 respondents.
And you're training as a psychologist. I know there's
That's correct.
Talk about the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, actually including picky eating as an eating disorder. Now, that would raise some skeptical eyebrows. Tell us, is that something that you've pretty much are standing behind?
I would say the jury's still out. I think that our quest for this characterizing adults with selective eating was that there's a subgroup of children, mainly, that we're seeing who severely restrict food, seem to be indifferent to food, and it's impairing health and growth. And so the initial question was, what do these kids look like as adults, and is it still equally impairing? And what we have found so far is, yes, it is persisting in adults. It looks very different in adults than children. And so we have a ways to go in terms of, one, even characterizing the nature of what this looks like, but also in terms of whether it's going to be a diagnosis or not. What's clear is that there's a subgroup of people, not everyone, who's an adult with selective eating, but a subgroup who does experience impairment. And when you're experiencing impairment because of symptoms, that's when you're getting into the realm of disorder. So it's a matter of degree, I would say.
Yeah, but it opens up questions about insurance and so forth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And certainly the people that present, you know, for treatment are struggling a great deal. As Stephanie mentioned, the social aspects of it seem to be the most impairing for adults.
But a lot of them have health and nutritional problems, especially the children, no?
You would think that they would. I mean, the data linking the two has not been conducted. But if you just look at it logically in terms of, you know, fruits and vegetables being associated with disease prevention, and those are the things that selective eaters, you know, have struggled to eat, you know, just by corollary, you would think that there's implications for health problems.
How much do we really know about the role biology plays in all this? I mean, taste receptors, things like that, as opposed to psychological aspects of the way people were raised? Or can we even separate them?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to, like, be the cheerleader for the parents out there, you know, because it's like you said in your own story, right? These parents, you know, the narratives of describing one kid who is just food adventurous and in the same family a severely selective eater, and they're in the same home environment. You know, really, parents have been given a bad rap for this, I really think.
But you can work particularly with children. I mean, I advisedly use the word rehabilitation here. I mean, you can and have shown results. And I believe a lot of the training and the treatment has to do, at least in the beginning, with teaching them assertiveness skills.
Yeah, I think that's so critical and important. I think that there's a certain treatment package out there that I think is really helpful that you definitely incorporates the assertiveness skills, the self-disclosure part of it, but also the sensory aspect of it. So what we haven't done very well is incorporated some strategies that are used by occupational therapists to deal with these sensory sensitivities. We've just gone at it from an anxiety perspective, which is just expose them. And exposure, unfortunately, when you don't address the sensory piece in a really graduated way, I think doesn't work.
So that's desensitizing. Like, people are afraid of elevators, take them into an elevator slowly and get them used to elevators. Like, this is a 5-day treatment?
No, yeah, I wish it was a 5-day treatment.
How long?
It does. I mean, this speaks to your development point. If you get them early, it's easier for sure. The adults that I work with, I mean, these adults are working very hard to gradually introduce food so that they don't gag. A lot of these adults that I work with, they're just very sensitive to gagging, and so they're just, bless their hearts, they're just slowly introducing these different textures and tastes so that they can do this in public, and it's slow.
And how much of it do you think is texture as opposed to smell or...
I think it's both. We found those two factors to be very highly related in our registry. The ones that are sensitive to textures or sensitive to smell.
I also saw from your research something that kind of threw me. I didn't know what to make of it. Almost all of those who have this problem with finicky or picky eating or what we're calling selective eating disorder, almost all of them like French fries and chicken fingers.
Salty and crunchy is a good... easy to chew, easy to, you know, the salt takes, to, you know, salty things are not bitter for sure. People are getting confused by that because they say it can't be biological if it's a processed food, but it's irrelevant. There just happens a smell, you know, chicken fingers don't smell. Whatever the qualities of these things, they're pretty universally liked. I agree with that.
So, you know, let me go back to Stephanie Lucianovic, who's here with us in studio, the author of, I almost want to say it like Sylvester the Cat, I have to restrain myself, Suffering Succotash. I'm looking at a Diet Coke here, which I drink now, and there was a time when I drank nothing but Coca-Colas, and then I found out I was diabetic, and I said, I got to drink Diet. But Diet Coke tasted to me like tree bark. I never liked the taste of it, and now...
You're used to it.
Yeah, that's what happened to you, basically.
That is what happened to me. I got used to things so that the stuff that I really don't like, I can handle it. It doesn't make me gag anymore. And then with other things, it was more I got used to it and I really liked them, like with okra, which I just fell in love with after having it done in a really well-done way by a friend from Virginia. And so I do think that you become accustomed to things to a point where you can tolerate them and maybe even like them.
You also touch upon in your book maybe evolutionary reasons, natural selection in terms of finicky or picky eating. What does that have to do with evolution?
Oh, do you mean my joke that the picky eaters will inherit the earth? Well, I do joke that picky eaters are not, because they tend to be more anxious sort and they don't rush out headlong, you know, where angels fear to tread. They're not going to go eat fugu. They're not going to eat poisonous puffer fish liver. So therefore, we're less likely to get poisoned by food because we're too afraid of it. And so therefore, all the adventurous eaters will die off and we will therefore ascend to a higher plane of existence. That's my joke. But as Dr. Daniel Reed at Monell pointed out, well, yes, or you will all starve to death. And then she cited some farmers in the 10th century who colonized Greenland from Scandinavia. And once their cattle died out, they had a very bad winter. They died because they didn't think to or didn't want to eat the fish that was surrounding Greenland.
It's also what you choose to joke about in many ways. Now, take something like cilantro. I mean, can't stand it. And I know there are many people excuse me, who feel the same way. It's something many people can't. But then, you can change.
You can change. And I do cite the article that Harold McGee wrote in the New York Times a couple of years ago where he talked to a neurologist about you can retrain these set pathways in your brain to accept or like things. But it's a gradual process. And well, you have to be willing to do it. But it's changing how you feel about the food emotionally and also by taste. And so, for instance, I don't like greens. I don't like sautéed beet greens or anything like that in a big pile. I can't stand the texture. The flavor's not enough for me to really love them. So what I did is I changed how I had them. I saute them in lots of garlic, which I like, so there's a plus. Then I made sure that they were chopped up finely enough that they weren't a big mass in my mouth, and I mixed them in with cooked farro or pasta, so there's this distribution of textures that I can tolerate, and I really like it that way. And it never hurts to add cheese, like Parmesan, because that's, again, a taste you already like, and you start to associate the like of that taste and that flavor, I should say.
Or Bob Lustig will go through the roof when I say this, but sugar, too, helps.
Well, I think sugar, of course sugar helps. All these things that your body is maybe naturally trained to like, that's going to help. It's going to help change that set pathway. Another scientist I spoke to at Monell, Dr. Wysocki, for a long time wouldn't drink lemonade because to him it smelled like skunk, so that was a bad association. He finally, one summer, was very, very hot mowing lawns and just drank it, and then he really liked it. And so now to him, skunk smells like lemonade. Lemonade smells like skunk. It's all good for him. It's not a bad smell.
Yeah. Now, I should add
the Smart Chappelle Show.
Oh, sorry. I should add that most people don't think that lemonade smells like skunk. But there are plenty of people who have learned to like the smell of skunk also. And familiarity is a huge factor in liking things, and there's a whole series of scientific studies showing that this actually does work.
So we got Sylvester the cat, now we got Pepe Le Pew here. It's okay. Can you say something, Marsha, about super tasters, which Stephanie Lucianovic writes a good deal about in her book?
Right. Well, there's some confusion about super tasters. Initially, it was thought that super tasting was related to ability to taste a particular bitter compound. That's PTC or prope. And some people have probably had those little filter papers in high school genetics lab. And to some people, these filter papers that have prope on them taste intensely bitter, and to others they taste like nothing. And so originally it was thought that super tasting was related to that. We now know that although that's a genetic trait, it's just that some people express a functional form of this particular bitter receptor and others don't. Now we think that super tasting may be related to how many taste receptors people have, how many taste buds they have, and it may be related to tongue anatomy, so that people with ratty-looking tongues, lots of spaces between the bumps on their tongues, are not super tasters. Super tasters have a lot of these bumps called papillae and therefore a lot of taste buds.
Excuse me, I'm coming up on a break and I want to give the phone number because I know there are many of you who would like to join this conversation and probably have questions and concerns and may indeed want to express them, as well as any comments you have about this whole question of picky eating and what causes it and what the results are and what there needs to be done to change it. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program, so feel free to call us now. 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways to participate in the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. We'll continue with our guests, Marsha Pelsha, Stephanie Lucianovic, and Dr. Nancy Zucker, and you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. How long does it take you to tell a waiter or waitress how long your food should be prepared? Well, if it's about 15 minutes, you may indeed be a picky eater. In fact, you probably are. And we have Stephanie Lucianovic with us, who lived in fear of having dinner at her friends' homes or going to restaurants. And today she's a foodie and a food writer and will brave eating most anything, even Oprah. Her book is Suffering Succotash, which examines why some people are picky eaters and offers some helpful tips, like how to deal with toddlers who will only eat grilled cheese. She's with us in studio, and on Monday she'll be at Omnivore Books in San Francisco, and on Tuesday she'll be at Book Passage, also in San Francisco. Marcia Pelshaw, also with us this morning, is a psychologist with Monell Chemical Senses Center, and Dr. Nancy Zucker is the director of the Duke Center for Eating Disorders, which is with the University of Pittsburgh, doing a national public registry on this. And Dr. Zucker, I just want to go back for a moment to that national registry with you before we get our listeners and callers and emailers involved in this conversation. And this is pretty much open to the public and an invitation to the public to become involved. But I'm presuming that what the data that you've explored so far reveals is this pretty wide spectrum and continuum that we talked about.
It does, although it certainly reveals that there's a certain subgroup who struggles with it more severely. So with the first 6,000 people that we looked at, we wanted to see whether there's what we call a pure selective eating group, which is a group that it's not due to that they have OCD, and it's not due to an eating disorder like anorexia nervosa, but that these people are selective in what they choose because of more sensory issues, and that is what we found.
But there is, I alluded to this before, a high relationship seems to be evident with OCD, doesn't it?
You know, in our data, we found that it was not related to OCD.
I think Marcia Pelshaw.
But anxiety in general, I think, is a possible associate. But I'm sorry.
Didn't you find that at Monell, that some connection to OCD? I thought you'd, Marcia Pelshaw.
Yeah, we do have some connection between OCD and some of the behaviors that that picky eaters show.
And forgive me, I should mention that's obsessive compulsive disorder.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, yeah. I need to apologize. I'm apologizing by saying it because listeners don't know some of them.
But that may be a separate group, a separate etiology. So there may be, as Nancy said, pure picky eaters, and this could also be a symptom of OCD.
So there's purism for picky eaters as well. I'm struck by you saying pure picky eaters. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always hard. You know, it's always hard where to slice the pie. So I certainly agree with that characterization. So for example, we don't. You know, the emotion of disgust, right, and the experience of disgust around food. There is a subgroup of individuals with OCD who experience high levels of disgust, fear of contamination, that sort of thing. And that subgroup would most likely be a group that also is selective in their eating and taste and textures related to that. So there's always some overlap.
Well, here's a listener who emailed us, a listener named Patty, who says, we don't necessarily get into diagnostics on the air here, but she says, my 11-year-old son became a full vegetarian at age 6, first no cows, then no meat, then no fish, gelatin, check your yogurt labels. Someone told me this could be a form of OCD. He also has a strong aversion to buttons since the age of 1.5. You have any thoughts about that, Dr. Zucker?
the buttons I can't explain, but I mean, she's right in that, you know, what you do when you have someone like that is you are looking to see whether there are these rituals in different domains, right? And things like checking and counting and things like that are kind of pretty characteristics of obsessive compulsive traits as a way to prevent harm from things. And so, you know, what's interesting is that the treatments that we've developed certainly have overlap with treatments with obsessive compulsive disorder. And so hopefully you can kill a few birds with one stone.
All right, we're going to go to our callers, and I suspect there are a lot of people looking for advice here. Heather, that may be the case with you. Hi.
It is. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling because my daughter used to eat everything, and then right before her second birthday, everything changed. And it was clearly at that point, I think, more of a texture thing than anything else. And as the years have gone by, I think there's been an anxiety component added to it because mealtimes are so stressful because what are you going to eat? Well, we don't know. There's like 5 things that you want to eat right now, and that's it. So I'm wondering if you have some practical advice for what parents can do just to make mealtimes pleasant and to help get our kids on the right track, especially with texture issues.
Well, Stephanie Lucianovic, I think, wants to step up to the microphone here.
So. I'm not, you know, Dr. Fraser Crane, so I can't, I'm not going to do a therapy session. But as a mother,
right.
as someone who has a three-year-old who at 15 months all of a sudden exhibited signs of picky eating while I was writing the book, and it freaked me out totally, and this is going to be advice you don't want to hear, but you mentioned the anxiety at the dinner table, and parents need to relax, especially at this age. I think sometimes there's bigger things at play here with sensory processing disorder, but also, I'm not saying with you, I'm saying that there can
sure.
be. But also, kids pick up on our cues. And my husband came home from work, and he could feel the tension in the room when I was feeding my son. And he was saying, you know, he's picking up on this. He's associating mealtimes with anxiety. So he's not wanting to eat. So you need to calm down. And I didn't take his advice, but I took advice from a occupational therapist later that I interviewed. And you know what? Amazingly, it worked. I just stopped getting so worked up about it. It was like, okay, you're not going to eat this? All right, fine. We'll move on. And kids have this weird ability of being able to balance and, you know, fuel up at another time. But again, I would get worried if your pediatrician was worried. But if it's just generally, it's annoying, just try to relax and know that someday they'll grow out of it. I did, even I was 27 when I did, but I didn't suffer any ill effects on my health ever.
But there's a big lesson in what you say, I think, and I'm going to defer here to Marcia Pelsha. I think your research over there at Monell has pretty much borne out the idea that if parents make a particularly big deal out of eating, either too much with punishment or too much with laxity, that is often the reason behind these kind of problems, isn't it?
Well, again, we don't want to lay the burden at the feet of the parents, but...
I'm not doing that. I'm saying there's
right.
a cause and effect, though, isn't there?
But, yes, and, well, so parents can do things that can make things better. Children tend to pick up on parents' general attitudes toward food, and if there is anxiety there, that can contribute to picky eating. Even if it's not, even if the parents themselves aren't picky, if the parents are the type who send their plate back to the kitchen five times when they eat at a restaurant, children will pick up on that. Catering to the child also may sort of allow them to be a picky eater. I should also mention that it's completely normal for toddlers to go through a sort of picky stage, and that may have some evolutionary importance because that's when they begin to walk around and eat on their own, and yet they don't know what is safe to eat and what isn't.
Well, I think, in fact, Nancy Zucker, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but in many cases that I've been reading about, you have children and adults who will only eat a limited number of foods. I mean, you know, it's amazing to me how they'll restrict their diet to like five or six things for their entire life or have done it for years and years, which suggests a certain kind of anxiety and a need for security in many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, you know, we're talking about this continuum, and those are certainly on the extreme ends, and it certainly takes on an anxious component because of the consequences of that extreme selectivity. And so, you know, I agree with everything that's been said in terms of parental keeping their own anxiety in check and not kind of adding to the sensory experience of a child who's already overwhelmed is a huge step in the right direction. But if you're an individual who only eats five foods, you're going to run into a lot of barriers.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Nancy, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, this is my program. I am the ultimate picky eater. I die if I have to go over to somebody's house for dinner. When I was an infant, my mother said I threw up every new food that was given to me. I was forced to eat food. I used to sit at the dinner table for an hour in front of the peas. I'd eat a pea and then throw up. I eat some vegetables now. My husband serves them to me, and I don't like them, but I eat them. But I can't eat fruits. Even the smell just makes me gag. It takes me 10 minutes to tell a waiter in a restaurant what to do with the food. I don't eat red meat, but that's by choice. And eating is sometimes a very difficult problem. But I'm 73. I probably won't change. My kids are not picky eaters because I never force them to eat anything, and they eat pretty much everything. But my granddaughter's a picky eater.
So. Well, just skip the generation.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. Good to hear from you. Let me hear from some more callers. Tyson joining us from up in St. Helena. Hi.
Hi there. I'm a winery chef in Napa, and certainly my view is very biased in that celebrating food is very much a part of my life, my culture, my people, my family. Vacations are built around eating and celebrating that. And my very biased and perhaps not the most compassionate contention is that people who don't celebrate the diversity of textures and flavors, sometimes there's other personality traits that go along with those folks. And I wonder if there's any kind of cross studies with personality traits of people who tend to be more high maintenance in what they eat, if it's a sign of something bigger than just that alone.
Well, Stephanie Lucianovic, shed some light on that question.
I want to point out that picky eaters don't choose to be picky. You would not choose to be a picky eater. It's not a fun way to live. Picky eaters aren't doing this to be annoying or high maintenance. And one of our biggest fears for a lot of us is that we are perceived that way, which is why when I went to restaurants, I did not do the When Harry Met Sally route of have this on the side, have this without that. I just didn't order certain things or maybe avoided eating them on the plate. So personality-wise, I think we've talked about that anxiety is one of the traits we associate with it. But beyond it, in the book, I talk about chef meet picky eater meet chef. And to the chefs, well, it's to say to both sides, I know where you're both coming from. When a chef presents a dish, he or she is saying, I understand every ingredient on that plate in a way that you couldn't possibly conceive, and it's awesome. I have no argument with that. They're right. They do. It's their job. However, the picky eater is saying, dude, unless you made that dish in my mouth, you have no idea what that dish is going to taste like to me. Because all I'm going to be able to taste are those little tiny minced onions whose flavor for me has taken over the entire dish. And it's completely individualized. I do agree that celebration of food is amazing. I do it now. My vacations are built around where we're going to eat next. But for those people who don't have that side of them, it's a preference. Just like we were talking earlier about what music we like and what we don't. Some people don't love food the way others love food. And some people don't love Miley Cyrus the way others love Miley Cyrus. So it's a very individualized thing, and we just have to remember we're all so very different, and any attitude of you're so annoying, oh my God, I'm going to roll my eyes, I hate picky eaters, that's really, really hard on a good segment of the population that just is going to go further underground.
So how do you feel about Miley Cyrus? No, I'm just kidding. Let me read some web comments. Listener writes, in relating to the relationship situation, I'll never forget. On a first date, I was asked what my favorite cheese was. To my date's dismay and astonishment, I responded with American. I was never exposed to worldly food as a child. I was a picky eater and do not regret growing up that way. Now I'm a fairly brave eater and try lots. Still very satisfied with meat and potatoes. And Tom writes, I was a picky eater until I went hungry during an overnight fishing trip in the Texas desert. Suffice it to say, after eating raw chicken livers that I was using for catfish bait, I did cook them on a flat rock. I heated them over a fire of buffalo chips. I felt better, obviously. I was 11 at the time. Since then, I've tried everything put in front of me. Picky? Try going hungry, really hungry, and see what happens when food is put down in front of you. Maya says, thanks for this great show. How does adding butter to vegetables like broccoli affect later eating habits? I've just started adding a little butter to broccoli with great success with my 4-year-old and 5-year-old. Well, let me go to the experts here. What about adding butter to food, Marcia Belchett or Nancy Zucker?
It certainly works. Cheese sauce works. Just in general, good preparation helps a lot with commonly rejected foods, and there have been studies that show that flavors do become associated with each other when they're repeatedly paired. And then if you present, say, broccoli by itself, it could actually be liked more just because of its association with butter. Although sugar works best.
Well, we're getting some interesting narratives here. I'm just going to give you a flavor. Diane writes, I was a picky eater as a child. In my case, most of my pickiness was due to food allergies. As an adult, I found that those foods I have an aversion to are foods I am even mildly allergic or sensitive to, like beef and wheat. In addition, I've also found that those foods I am most enthusiastic about, like blueberries, have proven to be full of antioxidants. I think pickiness is an asset, and I've learned over the years to listen to what my body is telling me about what I want to eat and what I don't want to. Another listener says, I've been a picky eater all my life. As a child, I infuriated relatives when I refused to eat the food they served. Fortunately, my mother supported me and provided both protection and alternative foods. The greatest pain I suffered from this was the emotional abuse I received from male relatives who expected me to clean my plate. Later in life, I became a vegetarian, grew to love most of the vegetables I disliked as a child. I believe that the traditional American diet was a big factor in my early food resistance. Had I been fed a healthy vegetarian diet as a child, I would not have had the same food issues. Today, I live happily and healthy on a very restricted vegetarian diet. And another listener says, I have a child who's a picky eater, but like me, she's very picky in many areas of her life. I read the book The Highly Sensitive Child by Elaine Aron and felt like it explained what's happening for us. Aron's argument is that a certain percentage of the population in each species has a very sensitive nervous system, so they are processing more of the information that everyone takes in, but others filter out quickly. She explains the evolutionary reasons for this. This makes a highly sensitive person more aware of various tastes, smells, and textures. You know, it's like there were people who, for a while there, said they were very, and still are, I guess, you know, very allergic, and this gets back to the olfactory, Marcia Pelsha, to perfumes and to smells mm-hmm. and to the atmosphere and to all kinds of toxics that other people were clearly, if not immune to, just inured to or didn't find any sensitivity to whatsoever. So again, it seems to me we're talking pretty much about a pretty broad spectrum here. Let me get some more of your calls on. Julia, hi, join us.
Hi, Michael, this is Julia. I'm calling from Emeryville.
Yeah, hi.
And I'm the parent of a 19-year-old son who had a diagnosed autism spectrum disorder, very high functioning, probably not noticeable to somebody who doesn't know what they're looking for now, because he had very good interventions. But mostly, he did really well for himself. And one of the elements of his profile was extremely picky eating, lots of sensory integration issues when he was little. And what I saw him do as a parent is he intentionally started desensitizing himself in high school to food and to all sorts of other things that were social obstacles for him. So I watched him intentionally train himself to deal with heights, which was a problem for him. I saw him intentionally tasting foods which were difficult for him. And now he's quite an extraordinary cook and a 19-year-old foodie, to tell the truth. But it was really fascinating to, more than anything, kind of accompany him. I didn't do anything, although I did really work hard to create a non-anxious environment at home because I knew school and the social world was very hard for him. But somewhere around 14, something clicked for him, and he decided he wanted to live the life he wanted to live and be able to engage in the social world he wanted to engage in, and he taught himself to do it.
Well, it's a success story. I mean, as far as picky eating, and I thank you for the call, although here's a sort of sobering comment from Ryan on our web. Analyzing the courses for preference is well and good, but I want to point out that this is truly a first-world problem of the privileged. Those suffering hunger don't suffer this indulgence. In our home, we grow the majority of our food, and if something grows well and is in season, we eat it whether our children prefer it or not. I'm wondering about cultural differences. Maybe, Nancy Zucker, you could comment on this. In fact, Christine, one of our listeners, says, I wonder if a lot of this is about the way we treat our children. I hear about the way French children are exposed early to many kinds of foods, and they're not picky at all. I don't know if that's true. Remember, we had, who's that author, Judy, who was on, Pamela Druckerman, yeah, who wrote about how French children are raised differently and how they're not the kind of problems we have. But what do you think, Nancy Zucker?
Well, I mean, I think what is coming up are these key themes in terms of what parents can take control of. So, you know, one's psychological attitude, the environment, the increased familiarity of different tastes and textures, and this kind of inculcating this atmosphere of food adventurousness, all those things are going to minimize any kind of biological vulnerability. So just great things to do, helping children grow the food and having really participating in preparing the food and making the whole mealtime fun, regardless of whether the kid's able to eat it or whatever the family norms are. All those things are as good as it can be in terms of if you have a child who's very sensory sensitive, increasing the likelihood that it's not going to be as impairing as it would have been.
And more of your calls. Paula, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. I really enjoy your show. I have a question in regards to the research that was done. Was there any correlation found between being a picky child eater and adult onset diabetes?
That's a great question. We did not. Right now, we have not looked at that specifically. In fact, we can't look at that. We asked people to rule. We ruled people out if they had a medical condition because that would confound kind of what we were looking at. But it certainly is a wonderful question.
Well, so I'm a picky eater since childhood, and I had adult onset diabetes.
Well, there you go. End of one.
One. Thank you for the call. And on to more calls. Let's go next to Marie Louise. Hi.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Morning.
Sorry, I'm getting hoarse. Well, I wanted to mention the fact I came from a family where my father had an exceptionally keen sense of smell, and my mother did not. And I was brought up by my mother mostly. And I would always smell my food. I mean, I wouldn't stick my face in the plate in a restaurant or anything, but the smell, my sense of smell is so strong that I can smell things, and it would very often stop me from wanting to eat anything. And I remember when we didn't have a refrigerator until I was 12, and the milk would come out, and it would be sour. And then I would say, I can't drink it, and my mother would then smell it and say, there's nothing wrong with it. You can drink it. Anyway, that's part of what I wanted to say. But beyond that, I also wanted to say I chew things so long, and I will not eat if I have to take a bite and not chew. Then I would rather not eat at all. So often when I am in groups of people, I take very small amounts of food on my plate, and then I nibble, kind of. And that's all I can do. And by myself, when I have my meals, it's chew, 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 chew. But
nibble, nibble, socially, chew, chew alone.
That's exactly it, yes. And I love foods, but I don't eat meats. And I've really enjoyed hearing what many of you have said, such a small thing as to add a little butter to the vegetables like broccolis or those in that family. And what a big difference that can make for children in particular. And so I thought I was going to say something else, but who knows what that might have been.
Well,
so
if you think of it, send us an email. But thank you for the call. And I want to go to more of your calls. I want to get Rona on here. Rona, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Thank you. I'm calling because our 21-year-old son is a very picky eater. We things since he was a small child, all the desensitization, occupational therapy, you name it. We've much done it all. He indicates it is a phobic thing for him. He is terrified of vomiting. And I've been considering looking into hypnotherapy as a way to help him. And I don't know if there are any hypnotherapists out there that do this. They do a lot of, you know, overeating, smoking, cessation. Just don't know of anybody who deals with people who are afraid of eating.
Well, you're in Redwood City. You should contact David Spiegel, who is a Stanford professor of psychiatry and all famous for his work in hypnotherapy. But I'm getting questions about hypnotherapy, and Dr. Zucker, do we have much in the way of results with picky eaters or eaters who have the kind of problems that Rona just described and hypnosis?
Yeah, certainly not data to show that it would work, although I certainly hear about, anecdotally I hear people trying that. I would say that, you know, what I do clinically for this fear of vomiting and these kind of hypersensitive gaggers, because that comes up a lot, is that is where we start in terms of trying to, like, destigmatize just the act of throwing up. And, you know, in the children that I work with, you know, we make up songs where we're gagging, and we make sure we decorate some barf bags, and we always have them in our pocket, and we do all kinds of things to make throwing up the worst case scenario not to be a bad scenario. And if we can get kind of past that hurdle, which you can with when they're little, then it opens up a lot of opportunities in terms of, because the worst thing that we do is puke all over the table.
And Nancy Zucker again directs the Duke Center for Eating Disorder, and Marcia Pelsha is a psychologist with the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Here's Rachel emailing us all the way from Playa del Carmen in Mexico, who says, I'm not normally a picky eater, but when I was pregnant, I, like many pregnant women, became super sensitive to tastes and smells. I was likely to gag even at the thought of red meat, for instance. I blame the temporary reaction on the pregnancy hormones. I'm just wondering if there could be a hormonal dimension to the chronic condition of picky eating.
That's an interesting question.
Yes, it is.
And
isn't it?
We haven't looked at that specifically. However, we don't necessarily find that adult picky eaters have fantastic senses of taste and smell, but rather they're more responsive to these sensory inputs. I'd be interested in what Nancy has found.
Some thoughts, Nancy Zucker?
Well, the only thing I would say is that my colleagues who are developmental epidemiologists have looked at the kind of the prevalence of selective eating by sex. And what we found was in children, there was a much higher prevalence in males. And then around the age of 11, there was a complete shift in terms of it switching over to females being more prevalent. Now, this is data that they're just kind of
by age 11, you said?
Yeah. So
like right around premenstrual?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's a great reader comment, right, and a very intellectual, great question.
Well, there's some real, are you endocrinologists listening here? I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Thank you. And thank all of you for really a most illuminating program. I want to thank Stephanie Lucianovic, who's here with us in studio. Her book, again, is Suffering Succotash, A Picky Eater's Quest to Understand Why We Hate the Foods We Hate. And she'll be at Omnivore Books this Monday, July 9th. And July 10th, she'll be at Book Passage in San Francisco. Thanks to Marcia Pelsha, psychologist with the Monell Chemical Senses Center, who joined us from Philadelphia. And Nancy Zucker, director of the Duke Center for Eating Disorders, who joined us from Duke University. Thank you, our listeners, and thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell and Tina Larberg, Amy Machado and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.